The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
And specifically offer some tools, cultivations about planting flowers or about finding more ease and well-being through the mental and then physical, emotional landscape. So very, very common weeds that show up for all of us at some point are these three. They're also sometimes called mind traps, which indicates that they're easy to fall into and hard to get out of. So the inner critic is a weed or a mind trap that shows up readily for all of us, and it shows up so much, I think, for many of us as parents with the intention to be of service and to be a teacher and to be a support and to share love and offer boundaries and condolences and guidance, and the list goes on and on and on. And it's so easy to feel like the inspiration is to do it so well, but the result of that inspiration is to feel like we're always falling short. And so the inner criticism can be there. And what I would advocate is that this inner criticism is not actually helping the inspiration. It seems like it is. It seems like it's a buddy of the inspiration or an assistant to trying to do well for our loved ones. But I want to offer the perspective that I'll flesh out more, that maybe it's actually just an obstacle to the inspiration. So inner criticism is one of these mind traps or weeds. The second is, you could call it kind of catastrophizing or exaggerating, where the world with our, not just our family, but the world in general in our lives can become so enlarged, and one incident can become so huge, one forgotten thing or one misspoken word or even a paragraph misspoken or one confusing glance that was exchanged between you and another parent while you were talking to your kid, and what are they thinking about me, and what does this mean, and or one conversation between you and your partner about the decision you want to make for your child, what's going to happen for them in the future. Any of these and more can become so enormous, and the mind can and easily does move to what-if scenarios that are catastrophic or terrible. So this is another part of the mind that masquerades as an assistant. I'm going to help you think about what the outcomes could be, but I want to again offer that maybe this is actually something that gets in the way. And the third of these very common weeds or mind traps is simply this kind of negative bias. A friend of mine uses the term stinking thinking. That is, as evolutionary science is now revealing to us, our default setting is to look for what's wrong and to look for danger. Just the brief of that is, when we were living outside without these wonderful protective walls and the lions were coming, we became very adept at remembering the lion and recording the danger and looking to the east where the lion came from over and over and over again. And so our brains have developed to be kind of very good at worry and very good at this default setting of remembering the difficult or remembering the danger. So with our young children or with our children of any age, rather, there's this difficult crossroads where there are so many difficult moments being a parent. Let's just put it out there. There are abundance of them every day that make themselves available to us. And our mind is so able to remember them, and because of this evolutionary brain. However, there are also these sweet moments that happen every day. sometimes even unnoticed by us. You know, it's like we're putting butter on the toast as fast as we can, and the child is showing us a beautiful picture or saying something really exciting about school or even just telling us a wonderful story about a time they had with friends, and we don't hear it because life is busy. So this default setting of we heard the moment that you were fighting with your brother, or we heard the moment that you didn't bring your backpack to the car, or we remembered the moment that you weren't listening to my directions. We're wired that way. I think it's really important for us to remember it's not personal, it's not our fault. So I want to look at these three a little more, offer some tools for them. But first, a joke. So on one street, there were three shopkeepers, and each of them was selling goods that were kind of useless and kind of expensive. We all know those shops. And kind of all the same. Each one was selling kind of the same stuff. And they were competing with one another, and they wanted all of the sales in their shop. So the three shopkeepers were really thinking, like, how am I going to get the majority of the business here? We've all got this same stuff, and it's all pretty useless, and it's all pretty expensive. So what am I going to do? So one of the shopkeepers put up a sign that said, best prices in town, and put it on his door, and that was that. People started to go in, and the other two shopkeepers saw this. Ah, what am I going to do? Ah. So the shopkeeper on the other end of the road put up, best quality guaranteed. So they started to go in there, okay? Best price, best quality, all right? Started to go in there, and the other two were, oh my gosh, what's happening? What am I going to do? The one in the middle of the block put up an enormous banner over the door that said, main entrance. And I actually feel like these three weeds or mind traps are doing this in our mind much of the day. Let's see, should I do negative bias? Should I do catastrophization? Let's see, which will I choose? You know, like, what is it that I want to focus on right now? Should I do inner critic? And it's interesting to look at the mind and see which one is claiming to be the main entrance at any particular time in your day. Which one is pulling all of your mental awareness right through its doors? So, the tools. Now, that was a bit of a recap of some of the things we discussed last time. And now let's get to the tools, which is the planting of the flowers. So, the inner critic is this voice that we all have to a greater or lesser degree. And you can discern, you can distinguish it from self-awareness, let's say, or even helpful self-understanding by listening to the way it speaks and even kind of the pronouns with which it speaks. So when there's a voice in one's head that, let's say you just spoke harshly to your child, which we've all done and we all will do, and there's a voice that says, I think that was a little reactive. Okay, I want to take a breath and slow down. This is not inner criticism. This is insight. This is knowing I was a little reactive, wow. Or even just maybe the voice would say, like, ooh, I am very wound up right now. I can feel the tension in my body. This is clarity. We need this self-understanding. However, we also all have experienced or might be familiar with this voice that says, you, and this is where you pay attention to how this voice is speaking, you are such a bad parent. I can't believe you talked that way to your child. It is unacceptable that you did that. Or I'm sure no one else you know does that. Or, you know, the way that you act when you get upset is so pathetic. You know, whatever it is, it's usually quite insulting, quite accusatory. And, there's this blaming quality. And the sense is that the inner critic is coming from outside of us. It's not an insight that comes from within, but it's this voice that's coming from outside that's often inherited or learned from somewhere in our life, in our history. And so what to do? What to do with that? So many teachers that I've worked with have really supported me and many others in developing a practice that is actually one of taking action. Often when we think about mindfulness, we think of this kind of very compassionate and patient space and kind of allowing and opening. When we're dealing with the inner critic, actually what we want to do is kind of bring up some of our inner strength and even fierce energy and refuse to allow ourselves to collapse under that scrutiny or under that tyranny, to really kind of see this mind trap has just swallowed me, or currently the shopkeeper is claiming this is the main entrance and as if these things would be useful to me, and to see clearly this is not actually insight. This is not discerning wisdom. This is me just berating myself. This is just having a bully inside of me run the show. And is that what I want? Because if a bully is running the show inside of me, chances are it's more likely that a bully begins to run the show outside of me. When we suffer from a lot of inner critic, we become outer critics as well. So it's very important. I think we all want to do well, and we need to really look carefully at, is this actually helping me do well? Is this voice of shame and blame getting me to the patience that I'm judging myself for, or to the kindness that I'm demanding of myself, or even just to the clarity or the communication that I want to bring to this moment? Is this self-berating helping? So when we can see that, we can take action with things like, and really literally talking to yourself is the practice, things like, you, this voice, you don't get a vote right now. Or things like, yeah, I'm not interested right now, or I'm not listening. Or things like, get lost. You know, some people have developed a voice inside of them that's very forceful to kind of defend against the inner critic, and it's been really helpful for them. Other people have found that it's easier, or not easier, not at all, I misspoke, but more helpful to be easy with the inner critic, to be gentle and say things like, you know, just this recognition, this isn't helpful. This way of dealing with myself or communicating with myself isn't helpful. I'm not going to do this right now. Simple as that. So we actually change the mental habit around it when we kind of take action and engage a different part of our brain. So if you can kind of imagine that when we are engaged with inner critic, to me it feels a bit like this fight-flight part of our brain, which is this back brain and this kind of reptilian reactive brain. And if we can get out of that reactive brain and come forward to this, what's called the front brain or this modern brain, and this is the center for empathy and understanding and compassion and care, when we can move into that with ourselves, right? Compassion and care and empathy for ourselves, then we have access to that part of our brain for another, for our child, for our partner, for our workmate. If I deal with myself, as I said before, if I deal with myself in flight, fight, back brain, that's how I'm going to deal with my children, my partner, my coworker. The other thing about that, though, is that sometimes it's not inner critic. Sometimes we put down a boundary that's too strict and we hear ourselves thinking, I don't actually feel good about that. That just flew out of my mouth. You know, no, you cannot have dessert for the week, or whatever it is that comes out of our mouth. And we realize, oh, that felt too harsh. That felt reactive. In that moment, that's not inner criticism. It is an insight, but there's also some tenderness going on inside of us. And so I want to say one way of looking at this voice in our head is this a voice that is aggressive? And if it is, I want to take action. Or is this a voice that is tender? And if it is, I want to actually move into this kind of space and kindness and what I call kind of allowing. I want to allow for this feeling to be here. Action, allowing. When there's a tenderness that shows up, I want to really respond with, that was a hard moment. My child is coming at me. My partner was talking at the same time. I was feeling really flustered. I just shouted out a boundary that I don't feel like is the right thing. That was a really hard moment. I'm suffering right now. I'm hurting, and I can see that my child is and my partner is, and here we all are. And really kind of enveloping that moment with allowing your feelings to be there, allowing your experience to be known by you, which is so different than if I said, go ahead and allow the tenderness when it's the critic coming in, and the critic's like, you are a bad parent, and like, allow the feelings around that. You're actually just kind of condoning or agreeing with what the critic says, which is not helpful at all. So finding that place, is this a place that needs my allowing and my tenderness? Is this a place that needs my action and my almost self-advocacy? So that's the tool with inner critic. When we look at this catastrophization or this exaggeration, what I think happens when we move into what if, and it's the worst case scenario, is that we become very kind of tunnel visioned. The only thing we see is the bad thing that's happening, and then we just amplify that. So it's like we magnify, we focus in and magnify. And in this tunnel vision, of course, we're missing what else is happening. And so this very, it's very simple, and yet in my practice of it, it's been quite profound to widen the perspective and see beyond that tunnel vision, that small amplified view. So, you know, young children are in the grocery store and having a tantrum in the shopping cart, and it's like this terribly embarrassing experience. We've all been there, whether it was 8 years ago, 25 years ago, or 1 year ago. And it's very difficult, and you feel like not only is it difficult for you that the child is tantruming, it's difficult for the child, and it's difficult for all the people around, and it's also very humiliating. So there's just so much going on all at the same time. And all we see, the tunnel vision just zooms in, and all we see is this trouble. I have to get this to stop because it's uncomfortable for me, it's uncomfortable for my child, and this embarrassment's uncomfortable, and it's just so amplified. And then the mind starts to say, I can't go to the grocery store ever again. It's always going to be like this. This is awful. You know, just all those things that the mind does to amplify and catastrophize. And then we're just like, my life is over. This is terrible. You know, this way that the mind can think these things. And if we can open up for just a few minutes and see what else is happening, and it doesn't have to be anything particularly special. It can be a stack of oranges. I see a stack of oranges. They're piled high. I see someone down the aisle who doesn't even seem to notice what's going on with me and my child and that fact that my whole life is crumbling. I see someone down the aisle who's very consumed in the mayonnaise. They don't care about what's happening right here. I see four people looking at me with alarm. There they are looking at me with alarm. That's what's happening right now. And this whole view gets wider. And the what was this insurmountable, just unworkable situation of a tantrum is just part of what's happening right now. It's just part of this larger landscape. So when we see ourselves moving in to tunnel vision and magnifying this challenge, whatever it may be, we can use this tool of widening our perspective, seeing a bigger view. We can apply the same thing to the child who won't do their homework, the child who won't get in the car when you ask them 7 times, the child who keeps forgetting their things at school, the child who, you know, it's all of those things. We can kind of sense and remember, even you can feel in your body, oh yes, I remember, I felt so entranced almost by that one thing. That was the world. And it was a bad world, and I was living in it. You know, that's kind of what happens in catastrophization. So when I'm, and this is true, I struggle with getting my kids in the car before school. It's so difficult. So when I'm, all I can see is, why won't they get in the car, and how many years of my life is going to be like this? I can widen out, and just sometimes I just look at the sky while I'm walking to the car. Just try to remember, oh yeah. There's still a sky out there. And just, you know, I'll even sometimes just hear my feet on the path that leads to our driveway. Just kind of listen to that, the rocks under my feet. Like, okay, that's happening too. Those things, and I can feel my body regulating itself as I move away from only focusing, obsessing, zeroing in on this trouble of getting people in the car to go to school. So widening out. The third is, I spoke about it a little bit at the beginning, but it's this negative bias. What science is indicating is that it is our default setting. It's our natural default setting to see the trouble. So there are no lions coming through the meditation center right now. And so we translate the lions often into our social landscape because we're such social beings. Sometimes it's monetary, sometimes it's, you know, achievement-based. But with children in particular, there can be like the lion is the tantrum in the grocery store, or the lion is the not getting in the car to go to school, or the lion is the not doing your homework, or just the lion is the yelling when you're upset, the child yelling, shouting when they're upset. Any of these things become a threat and ignite our fight-flight response. What I think is fascinating is almost to the same degree that a lion would, because we're wired to respond as if it's life-threatening. And so when we identify something as danger, the lion, a threat, all systems go as if I could die because my child is getting on my nerves. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, this is really happening right now. And that is neurological. That is actually happening inside of us. And when we can see that, oh my gosh, this very annoying thing that's happening right now is being translated as a lion, and it's not a lion. Okay, now we can work with this, you know, to see that, to see just how big the reaction is in me, to see I'm wired this way. This isn't personal. There's nothing wrong with me or my child. This is just what we humans have evolved to do. And now let's see what we can do about this. So really seeing this default setting gives us the ability to create a new default setting. So there's all this excitement right now about how plastic the brain is and how we can really change it, and how mindfulness is this incredible tool to change the brain. And yet, it seems to be true, all of it seems to be true, that we can watch ourselves moving toward our default setting, and that actually changes the way our brain functions. So for example, if my brain functions kind of over here on this side of my brain, this is not scientific, this is just an example, over here on this side of my brain when I'm in my default setting, if I begin to witness myself moving toward negative bias, I'm actually using a different part of my brain. I'm no longer only in that default setting mode. I'm now witnessing it. And then when I have 1 foot over here in default setting and 1 foot over here in witness, that gives me the ability to step out of the default and move toward cultivation, move toward where do I want my attention to go? Where do I want my perspective to land? How do I want to engage with this moment? That's only possible if I first see it. Use the witnessing brain, and then I can make some choices. So one of the most helpful flowers that I can offer about the landscape of the mind is about actually getting out of the mind. There's a cute turn of phrase, lose your mind and come to your senses. And I love that phrase because sometimes I say to myself, I'm losing my mind when everything's just going completely awry. And then I get the little, yeah, good, do, lose your mind and come to your senses. This is the practice. Do this now. And so here I have outlined all of these things that I totally believe in and practice myself daily about the mind. But there's this next really important component, which is about being beyond the mind. One of my teachers says, we can't think our way to peace. Try as we might. We want this peace, we want this ease, this well-being. We can't actually think our way there, because this peace, ease, and well-being is in direct experience. And direct experience doesn't come from thinking about what we're doing. It comes from experiencing what we're doing. It doesn't come from thinking about my life. It's experiencing my life. So getting out of the mind is the last frontier. We need to work with inner critic. We need to work with catastrophization. We need to work with this negative bias. And then we need to get out of the mind and directly relate to ourselves and directly relate to our children and our partners. And that, to me, is where you could say the magic happens, so to speak. That's where, oh, this is such a precious moment. And I'm living it. As I begin to put words to it now, it will sound like concepts, and so it's a little confusing, but I'm going to use words because that's our mode of communication. But these are, none of these are concepts. All of these are experience. So I work often with this idea of moving from, we've done a lot of looking at the inner landscape and moving to the outer landscape. So we need to be aware of the mind and the landscape of the mind so that we can navigate it skillfully. So I use this kind of teaching phrase. We need to know the landscape. We need to navigate the inner landscape. Know, navigate. And then we actually need to vacate. Know, navigate, vacate. So vacating the inner landscape is getting out of your head. Lose your mind. Come to your senses. Feel what's happening right now with your child. Even smell their hair. Even feel the warmth as you read them the bedtime story and they're cuddled up next to you. Even look at them as you tell them for the 19th time to do their homework. See them with your eyes. Hear them as they say, but I don't want to, or whatever it is that they say. Experience that moment. Live that moment. So the inner landscape for me, and maybe for you too, is so captivating. I'm coming to realize through these many years of mindfulness practice how in love with my thoughts I am, how stuck in my head I am, how interesting it all is for me. My whole mental landscape is so fascinating. And yet when I kind of take that step and sever the tie, break the tie, or maybe just weaken it, the world of direct experience can be just as alive, but I think it takes practice. So this bridge, I call it the bridge from inner landscape to outer landscape, and it's the process of walking out of your thoughts and kind of stepping into the world. And it's very simple, and yet it can be very profound. And it's just simple things like, as I said in the grocery store example, seeing the stack of oranges, hearing your child's voice as they speak to you, really hearing it, even looking at your partner as they talk to you. I think I didn't really look at my partner very much for the first year of my child's life. There was just diapers and milk and crying and, oh yeah, right, you, I remember you. You look older now, you know. Just kind of really kind of seeing and feeling and experiencing what's happening in this moment, what's here. So a couple obstacles to this that I wanted to point out. Our minds can be quite used to narrating the moments of our lives, just describing what's going on, telling us about it. And a favorite pastime of the mind, commentary about it. Oh, this is a good moment, and it's going like this, and this is a bad moment, and it's going like this, and I like this, and I don't like that, and you should have, and why don't you? And it just goes on and on and on, this constant narration. And when I hear that happening, sometimes I just say to myself, shh. And I get to just live it. What's kind of a cousin to this constant narration is this associative thinking, and the mind is so good at it. So we start thinking about one thing that our kid does, and we think about another thing that they do, and then we think about something that we used to do when we were a kid, and then we think about the way that our parent treated us, and then we think about how we don't like that they treated us like that way, and then we think about, and it just goes on and on. And before we know it, we're just thinking about, you know, red cars in traffic, and we don't know why. And the mind has just leapt and leapt and leapt from thing to thing. So this very skillful associative mind can, without us knowing it, occupy us just for hours, jumping from theme to theme to theme. So So sometimes I ask myself, is this helping? Is this needed? When I'm just kind of rambling in my mind, is this helping? Is this needed? And in particularly tense situations, I find that thinking is usually not helpful because I'm probably falling into negative bias, maybe moving into catastrophization, maybe a little inner critic is showing up. The mind traps are most easily available in these tense situations. This is a great moment to stop thinking. A great way to get out of the trap, get out of your mind, because that's where the traps exist. Another obstacle to being in the outer landscape, the world of experience, is that the inner critic can be very persuasive, very convincing that we probably will mess up if we don't keep listening to this onslaught of judgment and ridicule. So we should probably keep listening to this judgment and ridicule, or else the bad person that we are will really come to the surface and we'll start doing all those terrible things. It's just so interesting the way that the inner critic convinces us of that. It's been my experience personally and with, I can fairly say, everyone I've ever worked with this theme around, that our inner goodness is just beneath the inner critic. And in fact, the inner critic sometimes crowds out the inner goodness. When we start to quiet the inner critic, it's kind of surprising how much inner goodness is there. And in that way, I can describe it like this. Imagine if you spent all day with an old friend who you hadn't seen in years, who had turned into a very grumpy, judgmental person. And there they were at your kitchen table telling you everything you had done wrong and everything that was disappointing them. And then they followed you to work and they told you everything that you were doing too slowly and ineffectively. And then they followed you to lunch and told you how you're making really bad, unhealthy choices for yourself. And then they followed you and just went throughout the day ridiculing everything you did. How terrible you'd feel and how far away you'd feel from your own inner goodness. And that's what our inner critic does. We kind of forget how wise we are and how well-intended we are when there's this voice, this thought train picking on us all the time. So I think what we can do is use the mind to begin to live beyond the mind. We do need our thoughts to teach us how to move beyond our thoughts. And yet, there's this very subtle choice to be made about when the thoughts, even those that are helping us move beyond the thoughts, are no longer helping. So I think, in closing, I'll say, we can serve ourselves and serve our family and serve our husbands, wives, friends, workmates, through this, what is for me a very humbling process of investigating the mind, knowing, and then learning to navigate and learning to vacate. And in that process, there's this reconnecting with ourselves, coming back to who we actually are in real time, rather than the thought about who we are, the experience of who we are. And I think this poem from Derek Walcott speaks to that really beautifully. It's called Love After Love. The time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger that was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself. To the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. The time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome. Sit and feast on your life. So, these thoughts about thinking are really just invitations for each of us to explore and to come to understand what is true for us and what is not, and to just only keep and employ those tools which are helpful for you and to let go of those that are not. So thanks for your kind attention. Let's move into groups of two and have time to share in that smaller, more intimate context, and then a little bit of time to share in our bigger group. So the inquiry, it's going to be what's called a monologue. So one person speaks for a few minutes and the other person listens. And the listener just gets to be kind and silent and just open their ears. The idea to share about is, which of these weeds seems particularly alive in you, or these mind traps seems like the door that you walk through often? And describe that a little bit. And then how might you imagine one of the tools that was talked about, how might you imagine yourself employing that one? So spend most of the time just identifying and really getting to explore that particular mind trap or that doorway that you seem to walk through. And then just on the end, a little bit of one of the tools that seems like, I'll try that one out. So groups of two with the person next to you. And we'll share for 2 minutes each, and I'll time you. I'll ring the bell to have you begin, and I'll ring the bell to have you share one or two more sentences, and then a moment of silence. Okay? Okay.